From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're watching Hurricane Irma as it crosses the Caribbean. The storm brought 185 mile per hour winds to the islands of Antigua and Barbuda. It is expected to hit parts of the British Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico later today and possibly hit Florida later this week. Florida Governor Rick Scott today defended his decision to declare a statewide emergency on Monday.
The storm is bigger, faster, and stronger than Hurricane Andrew. We are being very aggressive in our preparation for this storm, and every Floridian should take this seriously and be aggressive to protect their family.
We are joined now by Philip Levine, who's the mayor of Miami Beach. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And you asked people to start leaving Miami Beach yesterday. How many have left, or how many do you expect to leave?
Well, we don't have an exact count, but I can just tell you word on the street is people are starting to heed my advice and starting to move out of the city, both visitors and residents. The county did a mandatory evacuation for folks with special needs. We have been in contact with our homeless population. We're offering them assistance, working with the elderly. But I just believe, and it's most important not to wait for an evacuation order, that if you have a plan, work with that plan, and if you don't, make one. But bottom line is, start moving out of Miami Beach. This is a very dangerous, very serious storm.
And where do you want people to go? Because at this point, it's not exactly clear where this storm is going to go.
Exactly. So two situations. Number one, if you have friends and families off our barrier island, we recommend that you go stay with them. Number two, when the evacuation order comes, which will be mandatory, the county's shelters will open up, and we'll be notifying all our residents and visitors the exact location of those shelters, and we have even special shelters where you can bring your pet. Now, of course, those shelters will be able to withstand storms.
What have you been doing to prepare for potential damage in Miami Beach?
Well, multiple things. First of all, what we have done is we've tried to get as many portable generators as possible. We started last week. Number two, we have portable pumps. Number three, we have been making sure that all construction projects, well, whether they be public or private, have ceased, and that all potential debris and materials are tied down or taken away. Of course, we are in full communication with our residents through social media, through the news media, making sure that they all take responsibility to have their own personal plan, advising them that if there is no water in the stores, use that good old-fashioned thing called the faucet, because the water in Miami Beach right now is clean and fresh. And of course, with this magnitude of a storm, the most important thing is the safety of our residents and our visitors.
What about construction cranes? Obviously, there are, as you say, a lot of construction sites in Miami Beach. What are you telling people to do if they live near one of those cranes?
Well, our building department is pretty savvy on this. These cranes will either be taken down, they'll be tied down, or they'll be put in a, hopefully, God willing, in a position where they won't be a threat to any of the structures, of course, or to our residents. And that's real specialized and specific, and there's codes that apply to those cranes.
Are you having to deal with tourists who are worried about either leaving or staying in Miami Beach for the storm?
Well, we work very closely with our hotel association, and they've gotten the word out to the hotels, and the hotels have begun advising their guests to start leaving, preparing to leave. And of course, if there are guests in Miami Beach that were stranded and couldn't leave, they'll be advised to go to shelters, and we once again will be offering assistance and buses to help people get to their shelters.
Mayor Levine, Miami Beach has been very active in preparing for climate change and trying to adapt to sea level rise. Irma is now one of the most powerful hurricanes ever to form in the Atlantic. It comes just after Hurricane Harvey, which set a record for rainfall in the U.S. Do you think we're seeing here the effects of climate change?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think these you know, unique, severe weather events are becoming more and more common, and we're going to have to expect them for the future. What happened in Houston was devastating with the amount of water and rain. Here in Miami Beach, we've been raising our roads, putting in pumps for the last 3 years. But as you can imagine, they're no match for a hurricane. Storm surges can go anywhere from 8, 10, 12, 13, 14, who knows, feet high. We've been dealing, of course, with sea level rise and normal rains and flooding and doing the best we can. And we're investing a tremendous amount of money to make our city resilient.
So over the next 24 hours, what's your biggest concern?
Well, I would say my biggest concern is making sure people heed my advice and the county's advice, our city's advice, to get yourself out of our barrier island. Don't take any chances. We don't want any heroes. Services will begin being reduced at a certain point as the storm gets closer, and it gets closer and it starts to hit Miami Beach. We hope it doesn't, but we have to plan for the worst and hope for the best. So my concern would be to make sure people listen. Your safety is utmost importance to the city of Miami Beach.
That's Philip Levine, the mayor of Miami Beach, Florida. Philip Levine, thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you for the opportunity. Bye-bye.
Well, to Washington, where Congress now has 6 months to legalize DACA. If they can't, President Trump tweeted last night, "I will revisit this issue." But today in a noisy press pool, Trump appeared to be asked if he had any second thoughts about his decision announced yesterday to rescind this program that gave work permits to almost 800,000 young people brought to the U.S. illegally before 2007. The president said, "No second thoughts." But will his tweet send a message to Congress that they don't have to act on this political hot potato? Because the president will. And will they even get to it? What with the long list they have after a month-long recess? NPR's congressional reporter Sue Davis is here. Hi, Sue.
Hey.
So how much did the president's DACA decision, you know, the rescinding it, shift the congressional schedule? And what do you make of that tweet?
You know, it certainly wasn't anticipated that immigration was going to be put onto the agenda. What's still not clear is where it's going to fall in that agenda. Yesterday, we saw a number of bipartisan senators, including Richard Durbin of Illinois and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, say that they want to move action on immigration legislation into September, that they want to deal with it right away. That being said, they don't get to decide the floor schedule. That's the job of the speaker and the majority leader, and they haven't yet weighed in on when they want to act. I think September is a little bit ambitious considering the number of other things that Congress has to address. But I've also heard reluctance from Republicans who don't want to wait until the spring, until a midterm election year, to deal with what is a very complicated issue.
Oh, it is such a hot potato. And that's why it's 16 years with no result on
yeah.
this. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Democrats will fight. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan spoke today and said this.
This is a home that people know, and they don't know any other country as a home. And so I think there's a serious, humane issue here that needs to be dealt with. But it's only fitting and reasonable that we also deal with some of the root causes of this problem, because what we don't want to have happen is another DACA problem in 10 years from now.
Yeah, but at a CNN town hall, Ryan told a dreamer who got up and spoke to him. She said, are you going to deport me? And he said, no. So politics there. But he also said a DACA solution would be tied to President Trump's border wall. Where are we in that?
Well, he did say what he said was it was likely to be tied to some form of border security. That's seen as potentially room for compromise to get Republicans on board. I will say that Democrats have ruled out strictly just funding for a physical wall as a negotiating chip. That being said, you know, a number of Democrats in the past have voted for and also agree that there needs to be stronger security on the border. Where the policy argument is really pointed is over building an actual physical barrier of a wall, which is many experts have said may not be the most effective or efficient or cost effective way to improve border security.
Yeah. Look, billions is needed in emergency aid for Harvey relief. Who knows what Irma will need? There are plans in the Senate to link aid to raising the debt ceiling, something fiscal conservatives hate. But would it be political suicide to vote against relief if it's attached to something you don't like, especially when the region in need is Texas?
Well, the House already voted overwhelmingly to approve that Harvey aid package. So there's one indication there that lawmakers do not want to be against this. It now heads over to the Senate, where if they're going to attach that debt limit increase, it's going to happen over there. And then they're going to send it back to the House where they'll have to approve it there as well. The goal is still to get that bill to the president's desk by the end of the week.
Okay. Flood insurance has to be extended at the end of the month, the federal flood insurance. The federal government also has till the end of the month to keep the government running. No small thing. Meanwhile, President Trump is talking about changes to the tax code today in North Dakota. He has to have Congress for that. But critics see this as massive cuts for the wealthy corporations. Here was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer yesterday.
If Republicans hope to avoid the same pitfalls that ultimately brought down their effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, they ought to abandon the misguided idea that one party can enact major changes to the tax code.
Sue Davis, where are we going there?
You know, he has a point that Republicans do intend to use the same process to get to a tax bill that they tried to get to health care, which is a process that lets them work around Democrats. They don't need to get 60 votes. They'll only need to get 51. It's too hard to say what it how difficult it's going to be yet because we haven't seen the tax bill. The big six, the big negotiators on this, met as recently as yesterday. They say they want to act that it'll be signed into law by the end of the year. But the longer we go without seeing a bill and those very complicated details, it's just hard to gauge where the votes might fall on something that still just exists only in theory.
Boy, Congress also needs funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. The president has nominees. Things are piling up.
They are piling up, but remember, Congress can always punt, and that is likely what we're going to see on things like keeping the government open and the debt ceiling and some of these expiring programs. They can just do short-term solutions, and we'll probably have a very complicated December as well.
NPR congressional reporter Sue Davis, thank you.
You bet.
This is Here and Now. A song called And the Sea from the Los Angeles-based duo Poolside, one of the tracks on their new album called Heat, a follow-up to their 2012 album Pacific Standard Time. Poolside has been described as daytime disco, music you'd expect to hear while lounging by the side of a pool. Their sound is a mix of relaxed beats with a wash of smooth electronics and high vocals. It's tropical and not. Joining us now from NPR West in Culver City is Poolside, Philip Nikolic, a Danish-born DJ and producer. Philip, welcome.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by the other half of Poolside, DJ Jeffrey Paradise, who came to LA by way of San Francisco. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello, hello.
And I want to start with how I first heard of Poolside, and I was actually Poolside, which I'm sure is exactly where I should have been to hear it. I think I was in Las Vegas or something like that. And this song came on. This is Harvest Moon. Now, this is a Neil Young cover, although it doesn't really sound like Neil Young, but where does your sound come from?
I mean, it was a bit of a reaction to the music at the time. Was like very, too, yeah, very dubstep in 2011, early 2011. And Philip and I were kind of at pool parties around LA hearing like that kind of dubstep sound that's very aggressive. And
I've heard it described as MDMA fueled.
Well, that that's the thing, is like that you know, like it has its own place, but we just never felt that you should play like really energetic, aggressive, pumping music at a pool party, where like that's where you want to like really relax and not, you know, be hyper. So yeah, that's definitely also a factor.
Had the phrase daytime disco already come into existence, or is that you guys?
That's us. We kind of coined the phrase.
You coined that.
Yeah.
And describe exactly what that means.
Well, for me, like, it was disco in general. Is if you listen to it much, it's all about like the nightlife and the disco ball and the crowd and Studio 54 kind of type tropes. However, there is kind of a few disco soul kind of songs that are very much suited for daytime chilling, but they don't really get a lot of time where you can play them as a DJ, so we set out to make music that kind of fit with that sound that doesn't really get a lot of airtime or credibility, or it's not its own genre.
And what have you found about who your audience is? Who wants this kind of music?
Well, that's the cool part, is that like there was a time in dance music especially where everything just got faster and harder and more kind of aggressive. And all of a sudden, for example, like Jeff's parents like love Poolside, and that's new to him because he's been in various like punk bands and stuff. And
they weren't big fans of those.
Yeah,
not at all.
So we have a, like, the age group for our music is really spread out, and we had like that, there was like a lady that came to one of our live shows in Costa Mesa that was probably like
retired,
70, we'll 80, call, yeah. Wow. And she drove far and she like bought our t-shirt and she's like, you know. Yeah. And for some reason that felt like way more awesome than like some teenagers or whatever.
It's, yeah.
Like, yeah, it's pretty cool that we're playing like hippie festivals and that's really cool. And then we play like a cool like house club one night and then, you know, a big wide-ranging festival and has a, you know, all ages. It's cool.
And obviously, like, a lot of pool parties, so, yeah.
But maybe soon nursing homes.
Potentially.
Not a problem, yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's listen to a little bit from your new album. This is from the album Heat, and this is called Feel All Right. Guys meet?
It's actually a pretty cool story. I used to throw events in San Francisco and I hired a band to come DJ an after party called Junior Senior from Denmark, which Philip was a touring bass player of, and he and I got to talking at the party, and kind of at the time, early 2000s, having a broad range of musical, you know, genres that you're into was pretty rare. Most people kind of had like, I'm into this and that's all. And he and I wound up chatting over like minimal techno and all sorts of other disco and electro that was popular at the time, and kind of just hit it off. And then we went to an after party and Philip entered a beer drinking contest with one of my friends who was like known in San Francisco as the best beer drinker, and Philip won, and so I was instantly impressed, and we became, it was just kind of good buds for almost, it's like 17 years now or something.
So Philip, you won a beer drinking contest. What did Jeffrey do to impress you?
He just had this awesome party that was really, really, really fun called Frisco Disco. It's still kind of like some of the funnest like DJ memories, so I came back to that club many times after.
What do you both listen to?
I'm like super obsessed with Spotify, and I kind of just like keep building this like one big playlist that I like to put on repeat. And It's funny because I don't listen to very much disco at home, at least. That's kind of like a different world. Like I listen to Scott Walker. And my girlfriend like to listen to Broadcast and Stereolab. It's endless.
And Jeffrey, what about you?
I mostly listen to records, and I would definitely say my most played record is Neil Young, On the Beach, which I've listened to many, many times. And I just have like a set of like maybe 5 or 10 records that I listen to a lot, like T-Rex, Tanks, that album I really love. And those two, and then Kraftwerk I listen to a lot. I don't know, it's sort of, those are just what I enjoy listening to while I kind of, when I'm in listening mode. And then there's a whole nother mode of like, okay, I'm gonna DJ, what do I want to hear? Or things like that, where it's a different space where I'm on my computer listening to music.
Whose voice do we hear in some of your songs? Or is it
that's
both
me.
Of you?
That's me.
That's just you, Philip.
That's me.
I knew I recognized that from somewhere.
Yeah.
That's Philip's falsetto.
Let's listen to another song from the album, and I want to let you choose it. What would be a good song to listen to from Heat?
I like the Which Way to Paradise song a lot.
Yeah, which we have right here. What has been the most amazing moment for each of you over the course of your success with Poolside?
I mean, I think I can actually answer is, like, when we started the band, we were in our 30s, and we kind of both thought, like, our career as, like, artists that perform was most likely coming to, you know, the last chapter. And Poolside was a very much, like, you know, for fun. You know, we had no expectations it would catch on. And I think for me, and something Philip and I speak about often, so is that, you know, we're just so grateful that by just some random chance that this project kind of had a lot of legs and has taken us all over the world, and we've gotten a chance to kind of do a lot more than we were expecting.
I have a specific addition to that story. Is like, for me personally, when we went on our first tour, I've always been playing in bands and stuff, but I never been able to sing and play an instrument at the same time, and I had to learn to play bass and sing on the same time. And if you ask most musicians, it's like, it's a weirdly impossible thing that all of a sudden clicks. But like, being in complete panic mode because I didn't believe it was going to work out, but I had a deadline. I had like a little over a month, was like one of the most amazing feelings, because, like, you know, the older you get, the more you think you're not going to, like, you're not going to learn like defining things in your life, you know. You're just like, you're more kind of like just like sitting on whatever you learned through your life, you know. So for me to learn something that was that groundbreaking for me personally was, I felt like a teenager. It was awesome.
You can teach an old dog new tricks.
Exactly, yeah.
That's Philip Nikolic and Jeffrey Paradise of the duo Poolside. Their latest album is called Heat. Guys, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can find a link to Poolside's new album and their tour listings at hereandnow.org.
And we're tracking Hurricane Irma, which has hit several Caribbean islands, as it heads to Puerto Rico, where the governor has asked President Trump to declare a state of emergency to give the U.S. territory access to federal emergency funds at a time when it's trying to reconcile more than $70 billion in debt load in bankruptcy court. FEMA has already sent more than 500 officials to the island. We want to check in with reporter Miguel Santiago of Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico. Miguel, what is going on the island right now?
Well, you know, great part of the island's really worried. We don't have a great electricity infrastructure. Yeah. Big places around the island are expected to be affected, floods.
Well, and you've had to evacuate the radio station where you work because of high winds. Where are you now?
I'm at my home. We were having some high winds. Now it's pretty calm, but we're expected to receive even more in the afternoon. We're trying to take precautions as great as we can.
Irma with 180 mile per hour winds and gusts, I think, was 220 last I checked. But what happens on an island? I mean, you can evacuate a state and try to drive to another one, but where do people go?
We have various shelters around the island. The government announced that it had close to 700 people on shelters. Mostly all we can do is just stay in our homes. Most of our homes are built on cement, so they can sustain the high winds.
Do you go in your basement, or what do you plan on doing?
Well, most houses here
don't have
a basement.
Right.
Yeah.
Are there schools that are cinder block? I mean, what?
Yes. Schools are normally used as shelters. We have people with civilians with wooden houses, so those have to leave. Some people live close by rivers and just huge bodies of water that are really dangerous, even though the house can be safe, but all around it can't. The road is the one that gets most affected by the heavy rains and the winds.
Are shelves empty? We're hearing that food and water's gone.
By Monday or Sunday, stores were pretty low on water and food. Certainly, as I said, you know, it's part of a protocol, so people grab as much food, as much water as possible.
And by the way, we hear a noise behind you. What is that? Generators?
Yes, those are generators. We, at the moment, we don't have power. You know, since we get a lot of alerts of tropical storms, hurricanes, you know, we've been like a week trying to be prepared. So some people are turning on their generators so they can maybe cook a little. But it's pretty much the sound you'll hear throughout the most of the island.
Look, this is an awesome storm. Is there fear?
Well, you know, funny thing, you mentioned it, most of newer generations here in Puerto Rico haven't really experienced a hurricane. Hurricane George swept by in 1998, which was Category 3. I believe Irma is Category 5. So most of us just don't know what to expect. So we're just waiting patiently. I mean, we've seen videos on social media. We're trying to be as careful as we can. The government, too, is trying to be as careful as they can. You know, high winds, you know, we've never experienced something like that. Less even a Category 5 swept by almost 100 years ago. So I don't think anybody alive has experienced a hurricane of this magnitude.
Well, Miguel Santiago, again, with Puerto Rico's Radio Universidad, we wish you all the best, and thank you for taking some time to talk to us.
Thank you for reporting. I really appreciate it.
Best of luck.
And as we watch Irma, we're also following the aftermath of Harvey, which soaked Texas last week. Joining us now is NPR's Carrie Kahn, who is in Houston. And Carrie, you've been spending some time talking to farmers about how they've been affected by Harvey. What are you hearing?
A lot of complaints and a lot of loss. It's bad. It depends where you go in the state, but in the southern part of the state where the large cotton crop is, farmers are devastated. They were hoping to have one of their better years. And they just thought they were going to clear up all their debt and this was going to be the big year. And now they're looking at huge losses. And then I was out in the eastern part of Texas talking to rice farmers, and they have a strange predicament going on. Their crops are wet underneath, but all the rice is on top, and it's come out, and it's drying to the point of not being useful anymore. The quality is so low, and they can't get their combines into the fields. They're just still flooded, and they just are waiting and waiting and don't know what their losses are going to be, but everybody is very worried.
Are they getting any assistance?
That's what they were talking to me about. You know, I went to a small town. It's called Winnie. It's about Winnie, Texas. It's about an hour east of Houston. And we asked to speak to one farmer. About 10 farmers showed up at this Cajun restaurant in town. The place was packed, too, and it was way past lunchtime. I just think everybody's sitting around waiting for this water to recede. And they just feel like all the attention is put on the urban areas and that the rural outlying areas and the farmers are being forgotten and they're not part of this disaster aid that everybody's talking about. It's all about FEMA and it's all about finding housing assistance, and they're really worried that they're being forgotten.
Is there any way to put a price tag on how badly Harvey has affected the agriculture industry in Texas?
They're not saying yet, because they might be able to salvage some crops. But what I've heard from agricultural officials so far is, like, just look at cotton. And cotton is the second largest agricultural product in Texas after cattle. Cattle is number one here. But that is a 2.2 billion crop last year. And they say at least a fifth of it is gone underwater. So we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars already lost in just the cotton crop. These rice farmers think their crops are totaled and they can't salvage anything. So we're talking to hundreds of millions of dollars in just in agriculture.
Meanwhile, you're in Houston. What's the situation there at this point?
Well, I could tell you that the two largest shelters the numbers seem to be going up. They were going down for a while. People were finding alternative places to live. And one of the largest shelters is still up, over 3,000 people in it. It's out in the outskirts of Houston here. And people have also been getting a lot of hotel vouchers from FEMA. Thousands of people are in hotel rooms all over the southern part of Texas. So the numbers of people that are still out of their homes are in the thousands, and it's going to be a difficult situation. Across the street here in downtown Houston, there's a large shelter set up for the George R. Brown Convention Center. They want to close that by the end of the week, but they still have over 1,000 people there. So housing is still tough for a lot of people. And then the other thing that people know in Houston is traffic. Traffic has always been bad, but one of the tollways, it's amazing to see, Jeremy. It's a 6-lane tollway completely underwater. It's a lake still.
Wow.
And so that's just forcing terrible traffic jams, of which was already bad traffic in Houston. And they said that water isn't planned to recede for at least another week.
And what about schools and businesses? Are they getting back to business?
Schools are set to start in Houston Unified School District on September 11th. And then what you hear a lot of people that, well, some of the schools are still having damage problems, but I think it's about a tenth of the schools in the district. But what happens is that there's a lot of teachers out there that are volunteering in these shelters and volunteering and helping friends and stuff. They all have to go back to work, too.
Right.
So there's worry about who's going to be volunteering.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn in Houston, where they are still right in the midst of the aftermath of Harvey. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, students walked out of classrooms in Tucson, Denver, and Chicago yesterday to protest the Trump administration's decision to end DACA. That program protects from deportation nearly 800,000 young immigrants brought to this country illegally. It also gives them permission to work in the U.S. And with the announcement that DACA is ending, school districts across the country are worried. Aurora Laura is the superintendent of Oklahoma City Public Schools, the largest school system in a state that has seen an 85% increase in its Latino population since 2000. About 7,500 immigrants in Oklahoma have received DACA protections. Superintendent, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And you said yesterday after the announcement that the ending of DACA would be a devastating blow to your schools. Why is that?
You know, I mean, this is something that is very stressful to our students. We need kids to be able to really focus on, you know, learning and focus on their future. And this right now is causing a level of stress both for kids and families and employees.
How many of them are DACA recipients as far as you know?
We don't have those exact numbers because we don't ask families for immigration status when they enroll. But we do happen to know that we have some employees who are DACA recipients who would do wonderful work for our school district, and we do not want to lose them.
And the majority of your district is Hispanic, correct?
It is, 52%.
Hmm. So how are people responding? Have you seen walkouts or protests at your schools in the last day?
No, but I did have a lot of principals reach out yesterday because students and families are very concerned. And that's why we felt it was really important to send a message very quickly after the announcement to let students know that they're safe, kids should still come to school, and that we are just doing everything possible to urge our legislators to find a bipartisan solution to this.
And do you think that they will? This is something that Congress has not been able to do yet. President Trump has called on Congress to act here. He now says that he'll revisit the issue if they don't. But what do you expect Washington will do on this?
Well, I really am hoping that they're hearing enough from people right now to realize that the DACA recipients are valuable contributors to our society, and there's no need to punish them and to send them back. So I do think that, that Congress will come up with a solution, and we're really just urging everyone to work together to find one.
If Congress can't come up with a solution, what are you going to have to do? Will you have to fire these staff members who are DACA recipients?
Well, we are trying to find out answers to that right now. And so we are speaking with like immigration attorneys to find out what would happen if it doesn't pass.
President Trump won the election in Oklahoma by 36 points. Do you think a lot of Oklahomans actually agree with the White House decision to end DACA?
Well, I do think that we probably have people on both sides of the aisle in Oklahoma City, and in the state of Oklahoma. But I just believe it's really important for us to send a clear message to families that schools are safe places and that you're valued, that you are welcome here, that no matter what your immigration status, we have a place for you in our school district. And so even though people probably are on both sides of the fence, I want to make sure our families know that there's a place for you in Oklahoma City schools.
Now, you're not a DACA recipient, but you are the daughter of a Mexican immigrant. What has this been like for you personally, or do you feel some special empathy with DACA recipients after what happened yesterday?
Well, it is something that is close to my heart just because my dad and his brothers and parents came here when my dad was a child. You know, my grandparents were factory workers in Mexico and wanted to break the cycle of poverty by helping my dad and his brothers get a better education. And it worked for them. And my dad was able to graduate from high school and went to college and became a nurse. And I think this is just such a great example of families wanting to find a better path forward, you know, to economic prosperity. So it is something that's really important to me. I love that my grandparents came here and that they were able to break that cycle of poverty. And for every other family that comes here for the same purpose, I want them to have that. And so, yes, I do. When I think about our students, there is a special place in my heart for them, and I want the best for them and their families. And so that's why it was really important to me.
What do you make of the administration's argument, though, that President Obama's executive action on DACA was unconstitutional, that the president didn't have the authority to do that?
Well, my personal take is that my job is about educating kids and making sure that every child has access to a great education regardless of immigration status. So, you know, I don't really want to weigh in on the politics of that, but every kid that walks through my door has the right to a great education. And so that's where I want to concentrate my energy on.
That's Aurora Laura, who is the superintendent of Oklahoma City Public Schools. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how is IBM's Watson for Oncology doing? That's the cloud-based supercomputer cousin of the Watson that won Jeopardy. Watson for Oncology takes in medical information and was promoted 3 years ago as a way to help doctors recommend cancer treatments in hospitals around the world. Ike Swetlitz is Washington correspondent with our partners at STAT, the health and science publication. And Ike, you and your colleague Casey Ross interviewed dozens of doctors and IBM executives. You found Watson for Oncology has been overhyped. What was it supposed to do, and what's it actually doing?
Yeah, so I think part of the problem might be that there's just sort of a public hysteria or enthusiasm, depending on how you think about it, about artificial intelligence, and people think that it's much more capable than it is. IBM has been doing a lot of brand marketing around Watson, and the big claims that they make about Watson aren't necessarily true about the specific Watson for Oncology product that people are buying. So a lot of people think that it might be coming up with new treatments for cancer. One of the things that Watson's supposed to be able to do is cut through human bias and come up with something that's sort of new or different than you as a human might otherwise do.
Well, and it's supposed to do this by taking in massive amounts of data. We said it was a cloud-based supercomputer, so it was supposed to take in things like doctor's notes, medical studies, clinical guidelines, and then spit out its treatment recommendations. But you say that one problem, you know, if the original intent was to avoid human flaws and biases, that actually it's humans who are making the final analysis?
So one of the sort of dirty secrets of artificial intelligence is that it's really only as good as the humans who are training it. IBM likes to make this claim that Watson can take in hundreds of journals and textbooks and millions of pages of text that help it make decisions, but that isn't the data that's actually going into the algorithm that's giving you the treatment recommendation that comes out of Watson for Oncology. All of the training that impacts what treatment recommendation is given comes from doctors at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City. Those doctors will provide what's called a set of training data. So example patients with certain characteristics, age, gender, cancer, status, things like that, and then what those doctors would recommend the treatment to be. They're not putting in the data yet about how those patients actually fared.
Well, and that's one of the problems with the claims, because the claim was that it would come up with new insights and identify new approaches to cancer care. And right now it seems like you've found that the system isn't creating new knowledge.
Right. And just to be clear, the investigation that we did was focusing specifically on Watson for Oncology, which
right.
is one of their products. They are working with research institutions on a genomics project and matching patients with clinical trials and doing a lot of other research. So there is other work that IBM is doing, you know, that may be able to fulfill that promise in the future. But this product that we were looking at, which is being heavily marketed and also very patient-facing, we don't think it's doing that right now.
But might it someday? Because isn't that what is true about smart technology? It does learn. You know, so it might Watson Oncology improve?
Oh, of course. I mean, a lot of the doctors who I spoke with who were critical of where Watson for Oncology is right now expressed a lot of hope and optimism that artificial intelligence will get better in the future. They and us in our reporting are sort of raising the question that if we're not at that point yet, you know, how much should hospitals be paying for this?
Well, you've pointed out the flaws and you've said that some doctors do think it will improve. But in and of itself, are there patients or doctors who are already feeling good about Watson for Oncology?
Yeah, so doctors are definitely seeing benefits right now. One of the main benefits is that Watson for Oncology can save doctors time by quickly pulling up medical studies and medical literature that are relevant to a particular patient. And it can also very quickly and easily display data about certain treatments, like how likely you are to survive for a certain number of years if you take this treatment, which especially in hospitals outside of the United States can sort of change the power dynamics in conversations between junior doctors and senior doctors, because where junior doctors might normally defer to the senior doctor, if Watson's in the room, a hospital in South Korea was telling me a senior doctor would be humiliated or look foolish to continue arguing for a certain treatment if Watson was presenting convincing data for a different one.
Hmm. That's Ike Sweatlitz, Washington correspondent for STAT, taking a look at Watson for Oncology. Ike, thank you.
Thank you.
And staying with technology, baseball is investigating the Boston Red Sox stealing signals using an Apple Watch. What? A Boston sports team cheating? No. The Yankees made the allegation. Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred spoke at Boston's Fenway Park last night.
We are 100% comfortable that it is not an ongoing issue. That if it happened, it is no longer happening. And I think that's important from an integrity perspective going forward.
Stealing signs lets hitters know what pitch is coming. Apparently someone from the Sox saw the signs on a monitor, then sent them on his Apple Watch to a trainer in the dugout who relayed them to the players. Using your eyes would have been legal. But now you can add watches to underinflated footballs as a Boston sports legacy. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.